Welcome in, everyone. So to start us off today, I want you to think about this quote. You are not a noun. You are a verb. You are not a thing, but a process. Which, it sounds like a riddle, right? It's from Buckminster Fuller. But if you take that idea literally, it might actually be the exact key to breaking out of your most stubborn, destructive habits.
Yeah, it's a massive paradigm shift, honestly, because, I mean, we spend our entire lives trying to solidify our identity, you know, trying to figure out who I am.
Right, exactly. Always looking for that fixed label.
Exactly. But when we start trying to turn these passing temporary moments into fixed identities, we actually sever the root of these compulsive loops. And we're drawing this entirely from the Raft to Freedom program today.
Yep, specifically looking at the final stage of their framework. And just to orient you listening, RAFT is an acronym. It stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feeling, Train.
Right.
So we are sitting right in the heart of that final stage, which is train. The earlier stages, they're more about surveying the hazards, you know, the treacherous waters of the mind.
Which is super necessary. But train is where you really look inward. It asks you to look at the navigator steering the raft, this whole concept we call the self, and watch how it's actually being assembled in real time.
Yeah, it's like looking under the hood.
Exactly. Because to train the mind, you first have to observe what it's doing on autopilot. And what it does relentlessly is this activity called selfing.
Selfing, with an ing.
Right, selfing. It's crucial to view this as a verb, like an ongoing action rather than a static object. So a thought pops into your head or a feeling of anxiety arises.
Or you just have a really bad moment at work.
Yeah, you experience a momentary failure. And the mind's immediate exhausted reaction is to just grab that passing event and declare, this is me, this is mine, this defines me.
So the brain is essentially taking a fluid verb like experiencing stress and solidifying it into a noun, like my anxiety or my brokenness.
Yes.
And there's this great metaphor in the RAFT program about a leaky boat, because nothing in our experience actually stays fixed. We just constantly feel groundless, like we're taking on water.
We're always sinking.
Right. And to stop that sinking feeling, we endlessly bail the boat. We bail it with, you know, doom scrolling or buying something online we don't even need or whatever habit gives us a hit. We just do whatever it takes to keep our identity narratives afloat.
We do it because it promises this temporary payoff, a fleeting feeling of safety. But the mechanics behind it are just exhausting.
So exhausting.
And if you look at modern neuroscience, this self-referential storytelling, it maps directly onto the brain's default mode network, the DMN.
Right, the DMN.
Yeah, when you aren't engaged in a specific focused task, the DMN lights up. It's the system that rehearses the future, replays the past, and just generates that continuous internal narrative.
So it's basically like all those background apps draining my phone's battery. That's a perfect way to put it, actually.
I mean, I'm not actively using them, but they're running this massive invisible narrative in the background that I constantly have to feed energy into. That is highly accurate. You are burning cognitive energy, continuously building and rebuilding the protagonist of that narrative. And Lisa Feldman Barrett's work on constructed emotion explains the how of this beautifully.
Oh, I love her work.
It's so good. Her research shows the brain is essentially a prediction engine. It isn't just passively reacting to the world. It's actively using past learning to construct a best guess experience of what's happening right now.
So it takes raw physical sensations and immediately tries to predict what they mean by just slapping labels on them.
Exactly. But wait, this brings up a huge red flag for a lot of people.
Yeah, I was going to say, if the self is just this exhausting story driven by background apps and prediction errors, shouldn't we just delete the app entirely?
Right. Just shut it all down.
But if I aggressively dismantle myself, wouldn't I just, you know, dissociate? Like, am I going to punch a hole in the universe and become some emotionless blank slate or completely detached from the people I love?
It's a super common fear. But the goal here is cognitive diffusion, not dissociation. This is heavily used in modern psychology, particularly in ACT acceptance and commitment therapy.
Okay, so diffusion.
Yeah, diffusion means stepping back and seeing thoughts as just thoughts rather than absolute truths. Dissociation is, well, numbing out and disconnecting from reality entirely.
Which we do not want.
No, not at all. To understand why we aren't going to turn you into a blank slate, we need to look at what we mean by self. There are essentially four dimensions of the self, and we are only dismantling one of them.
Okay, break those down for us. What are we keeping and what are we dismantling?
Sure. So dimension one is the ontological self. This is the concept of a permanent, unchanging core, like a soul or some essence sitting right behind your eyes.
Right.
Well, Gautama the Buddha explicitly denied that this exists. So you don't even have to worry about dismantling a permanent core because from this perspective, it isn't there to begin with.
Fair enough. You can't break what isn't there.
Exactly. Then dimension two is the developmental self. This is your healthy agency. It's your functional capacity to regulate your emotions, make ethical choices, connect your wishes to your actions.
So it's the self as a psychological skill set.
Yes.
And we definitely want to keep that. I mean, we don't want to lose our ability to just function in society.
No, we actively want to cultivate it. Then dimension three is the reflexive pronoun. This is just the ordinary, harmless use of the words I and me for daily communication.
Oh, right. Like grammar.
Yeah. You still need to be able to say, I am hungry or I am feeling sad today so people can relate to you. It's just language.
Which leaves the fourth dimension as the culprit.
Yes. The fourth dimension is conceit or ego. This is the self thing we just discussed. It's that habitual, painful grasping at experience as me and mine.
It's the compulsion to take a passing prediction and turn it into a permanent identity.
Exactly. And that is the only dimension we are dismantling in this training stage.
Okay, so we keep the life skills, we keep the language, and we just disassemble that painful grasping.
Right.
But how do we actually do that when the DMN is running at full speed? I know the RAFT program breaks this fourth dimension down into five moving parts. Chapter 54 is all about this, the five components of self.
It is, yeah.
But instead of just listing them off like a textbook, let's put this into a real-world scenario so we can see how it works. Let's say it's Tuesday morning, and you get a vague two-word text from your boss that just says, call me.
Oh, a perfect trigger for a compulsive loop.
Right. Panic mode.
So let's watch the disassembly line activate. The very first component to fire is form. In the RAFT metaphor, form is the hull of the boat. It's the physical side of life. Your body, the material world, your sense organs.
Okay, so when you read that text, form is the sudden hit of cortisol.
Exactly. It's the physical tightening in your chest, the slight acceleration of your heart rate.
It's starting physical.
Yeah.
And chapter 54 notes that the defining characteristic of form is that it changes. It gets tired. It reacts.
Yes.
But the problem is we treat that physical chest tightening not as a biological process, but as a deeply personal crisis.
Which triggers component number two almost instantaneously, which is feeling tone.
The feeling tone.
Right. If form is the hull, feeling tone is the compass needle. This is the nervous system's instant pre-verbal tag. It tags every single interaction as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral.
Oh, ah, or meh.
Hug, ah, or meh.
Yeah.
I love that. So with that text message, your system instantly generates a harsh, unpleasant, feeling tone.
Yes, it's immediate.
But why does the brain even bother with the feeling tone? Like, what's the point?
It's basically an evolutionary shortcut. It is much faster to feel unpleasant and pull your hand away from a hot stove than it is to, you know, cognitively calculate the exact temperature of the burner.
Oh, that makes sense.
So feeling tone is raw, vital data. The danger arises because the feeling tone doesn't stay raw for more than a fraction of a second.
Because the brain hates ambiguity. It needs to know why it feels an uff. Which brings us to component number three, which is perception, the navigational markers.
Right. The mind takes that raw data and slaps a label on it to make sense of it.
And this is where Lisa Feldman-Barrett's prediction model really shines.
Right. Exactly. Perception is a meaning-making system. It reaches into your past memories, your history, your biology to predict what this unpleasant feeling means. So it labels the text message, threat. I'm getting fired. I am a failure.
But hold on. Meaning-making sounds like a positive thing. If it's a survival feature, why is perception such a liability here?
Because perception is heavily conditioned, and therefore it is frequently just wrong. To save cognitive load, the brain categorizes an unpredictable fluid feeling as a fixed, known threat, so it knows how to react.
Wow. Okay.
And when a destructive habit is active, perception gets completely skewed. It mislabels reality. It labels a harmful compulsion as relief. It labels an ordinary moment of discomfort as unbearable pain.
It packages sense data, pastes a static label on it, and demands you treat that subjective label as objective fact.
You nailed it.
That makes so much sense. It takes the verb of experiencing an unpleasant feeling tone and turns it into the noun of my impending doom.
Yes.
And once that perception locks in, the body just demands action, which is component number four, impulses and urges. The tide.
The tide is the do something energy. The feeling tone was unpleasant. The perception labeled it a threat. And now the urge floods the system. The urge to lash out, the urge to quit your job before you get fired, or the urge to completely numb out with a destructive habit just to quiet the noise.
But earlier you said we have agency. If the urge is completely flooding my system, how do I actually stop it?
By recognizing the mechanism. An urge is a learned push, driven by repetition. It is not an undeniable command. In the space between the impulse and the action, choice exists.
Okay.
You don't need to surgically remove the urge from your brain to be free. You just need to recognize it as a movement in the nervous system, like a passing weather pattern, rather than an instruction you have to obey.
A movement in the system. Okay, so we have form, feeling, tone, perception, and impulses. What's the final component?
Component number 5 is consciousness, the lighthouse beam. This is simply the knowing that all of the previous 4 components are occurring.
It's just the awareness of it.
Right. It's the bare fact that experience is being known moment by moment. It illuminates the heart racing, the unpleasant tone, the threatening label, and the urge to numb out.
Now, I have to stop you here because I see a massive trap hiding inside consciousness.
Oh.
Yeah. If I successfully step back and I watch my heart racing and I watch the urge to, you know, numb out, I can very easily say, look at me. I am the pristine, untouched awareness observing all this chaos.
Yes.
I can accidentally build a completely new, arrogant ego around how zen and detached I am. It feels like playing a game of psychological whack-a-mole. I crush the ego of my anxiety only to inflate the spiritual ego of the wise watcher.
That is a brilliant observation and honestly a very common trap. The distinction between wisdom knows this anxiety is happening and I am a deeply wise person observing anxiety is subtle but profound.
Yeah.
The first approach loosens suffering by keeping everything as a process. The second approach just tightens a new loop of selfing. It turns the verb of knowing back into a noun of the knower.
Okay, so understanding this disassembly line is fascinating in a controlled environment. But let's be real.
Let's do it.
When you are in the wild and a wave of panic hits you or a massive craving drops out of nowhere, you do not have time to map out Lisa Feldman Barrett's neuroscience.
Yeah.
You aren't analyzing feeling tones. Philosophy goes straight out the window.
Right, it absolutely does.
How does the RAFT program suggest we actually use this in the heat of the moment?
Well, when self-identity tightens, it rarely announces itself as a big philosophical claim, right? It shows up as quiet assumptions that feel terrifyingly true. This anxiety is me. I must obey this urge.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of arguing with those assumptions, the training suggests running a few practical diagnostics. The first is a direct check on ownership.
Oh, the control test.
Yep.
I want to challenge everyone listening to try this today.
It's so effective.
The next time a strong mood or an intense urge hits you, just stop and ask yourself, did I choose to feel this? Can I make it stop instantly, right now, just because I demand it?
And the honest answer is almost always no. And if you cannot control it, it is a process, not a possession. You are not the owner.
Right.
The body and mind are doing something you didn't ask for. It is being shaped by causes and conditions, past memory, current stress, biological contact, not by a little CEO inside your head pulling levers.
It's incredibly relieving, honestly. If I can't command it to stop, it isn't me. It's just weather. Exactly. It's just weather. The next diagnostic is the 3 checks. Imagine you're a mechanic listening to a car engine, trying to locate a rattle. You run the experience through 3 questions. First, is it stable?
Okay.
Bring your attention to the raw data of the anxiety or the urge. Is it a solid, unchanging block of lead in your chest, or is it pulsing, moving, rising, and falling?
Well, if you actually pay attention to the physical sensation, it is always moving. It's never a static block. Right. Second check. Is it reliable? Notice what happens when your mind grips it, when it tries to tightly control the feeling or forcefully shove it away. Do you settle into peace or do you strain?
Oh, clinging to it or even aggressively fighting it definitely creates more strain and stress.
Which leads to the third check. Is it me or mine? If this sensation is constantly shifting and it generates stress when you cling to it and you cannot command it to stop on demand, is it really a sensible candidate to call who I am?
Logically, no. If it's shifting and uncommandable, it cannot be you.
Exactly. And when you run those checks and you see the illusion for what it is, the RAFT program offers this incredibly simple reset. It's a refrain you can use the moment the mind tries to glue your identity onto a passing event.
Right. You just say it to yourself, not mine, not me, not myself.
Let's unpack the mechanics of that refrain, actually. Not mine means it isn't your property. It is just a condition arising in the nervous system.
Yeah.
Not me means it isn't an identity. It is just a fleeting moment in time. And not myself means it isn't your permanent inner essence. It is just a biological and psychological process.
It's not my, not me, not myself. It completely breaks the slide where the DMN says, because this unpleasant feeling is here, it means I am fundamentally broken. Therefore, I must engage in my destructive habit. It just turns identity back into mere information.
It does.
But I want to push back a little on behalf of anyone trying this. Let's say I run the control test. I do the three checks. I say the refrain. I logically understand the five components of chapter 54.
Okay.
But I still feel a very strong, lingering sense of I. I still feel like me, and the urge is still humming in the background. It is so frustrating because it makes you feel like the training is failing.
Oh, it is entirely normal, and you are not failing at all.
Yeah.
Deconstructing the self is not an instant magic trick. There's a beautiful pair of metaphors from an ancient monk named Kimaka that perfectly normalizes this lingering ego.
I love these metaphors.
He compared the sense of self to the scent of a flower. We logically know the scent belongs to the flower, but it is incredibly difficult to separate the invisible fragrance from the physical bloom itself.
Right. They are so intertwined, you can't just pull them apart on command.
Exactly. Or think of a laundered cloth. You wash a dirty cloth with soap, and it is entirely clean. But a faint smell of the soap remains in the fabric until it is properly aired out over time.
That's such a good way to look at it.
Deconstructing the self is a gradual airing out. Hmm. We are not trying to violently force the feeling of I to vanish. We're just learning to recognize selfing as a conditioned activity. We stop feeding it new narratives, and over time, the grip softens on its own.
What is truly amazing is how universal this realization is. I mean, we've talked about Gautama and ACT therapy, but you see this across so many disciplines.
Oh, absolutely.
The 18th century philosopher David Hume famously looked inward to find his permanent self and reported that he couldn't find an owner anywhere. All he found was a stream of passing perceptions: heat, cold, pain, pleasure.
It's a universal human truth. When you look closely at the machinery of the mind, you don't find a noun. You find a verb. And treating ourselves as living fluid processes instead of fixed, broken objects completely changes the game when it comes to navigating the difficult moments of life.
It really does. Now, before we wrap up, I want to make sure you know exactly where to find all of this material. The concepts we explore today come from the RAFT to Freedom Workbook,
yeah,
which is written by Dr. Kathleen. Freely available online. You can find the link to their website at raft2freedom.org. It is phenomenal.
Highly recommend checking it out.
But I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on that builds on what we've discussed. We talked about how the brain's default mode network constantly builds this me movie and how perception slaps labels on feeling tones.
Right.
Consider for a moment how modern algorithms and social media platforms are literally engineered to hijack this exact disassembly line.
Wow.
They were designed to intentionally trigger unpleasant feeling tones like outrage or insecurity. Knowing your perception will instantly label it a threat, and your impulses will generate an urge to click, comment, or buy. In a way, we are outsourcing our selfing to servers. We're letting an algorithm direct our DMN.
That is a chilling but highly accurate application of these concepts. To reclaim your agency from both your own autopilot and external algorithms, I want to offer a self-reflection directly from the RAFT program to take into your day.
Let's hear it.
When a strong moment hits today, whether it's an intense craving, a wave of shame, panic, or anger, can you pause and name what is actually here? Can you identify the physical body sensation, the instant feeling tone, the label your perception applies, the urge to act, and the simple knowing of it all?
Yeah.
And then crucially, notice what story is being added on top.
Spotting the story is the key to the cage. I will close our discussion today with a striking quote from the end of the chapter from Jon Kabat-Zinn. He writes, "It is remarkable how liberating it feels to see that your thoughts are just thoughts and that they are not you or reality. Keep exploring that process. Keep noticing the verbs, and we will catch you next time."